Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
The difference between the value of those grapes is our making. Pats and Hall on the label makes the difference. It's not your making, Andy, and I say again, I have the greatest respect for the guy, but I just don't buy into that particular marketing scheme on his side. And it's worked out great for him. He's got plenty of people who want to do that. So he didn't need us, but it just sort of blew my mind.
Curious. So your own palatal journey, the same reality.
Palatial journey.
Yeah. But I happen to know that you're a very avid consumer of wine.
No.
Yes, you are. You can't deny that because I've drank with you, so there.
I can't imagine somebody in the wine industry who is willing to do the hard work that you have to do in order to be successful doesn't actually like the product that they're making. Not just theirs, but other people's efforts as well. If you don't like it, why are you bothering? This is too much work and for too little pay to just do it as a business, I think.
So
anyway, yes, go ahead.
What are you drinking similarly to what you were drinking in the 90s, 2000s?
Of course not. No.
I think what's happening?
Everybody wanders around in their wine drinking world. Back when I first got interested in wine, so that would have been the mid-70s, really, Pinot Noir would have been the last thing I would have looked for on a wine list, at least Pinot Noir from California.
Really?
And Burgundies were too expensive. Even then, they were, you know, a substantial jump up in price. I lived in Oregon. I did like Oregon Pinots, but they were rarely on wine lists, even in Oregon, which is kind of bizarre. But anyway, so I started off drinking all kinds of different stuff. Because I lived in Oregon and the wine industry was there, but it was also very small, it was sort of encouraging to be able to try lots of different stuff. I particularly was fond originally of German Rieslings. I still think Riesling is an amazing grape. It's really underdone in California. I think there's spots here where Riesling could be fabulous, but it has just never really taken off in the way that I think it would be interesting to see it. So I drank a lot of German Rieslings, especially from 76 and 75, which were fabulous years there, and really enjoyed those. I drank Oregon wines, of course. I drank some Washington State wines because I was in Oregon and they were close. But I really focused a lot on California wines because it was a dynamic moment in the wine industry. It was, you know, a year or two after that big wine tasting in Paris where, you know, Chateau Madeleine and Chardonnay beat all the white Burgundies, and Stag's Leap wine cellars beat all the big Bordeaux guys, and really set the world on its ear about wine and the potential of wine. And that, so it was an exciting time where there was lots of discovery. I really liked Zinfandel. I was having a blast drinking Zinfandel, and I had a friend of mine who had a retail store in California, and every once in a while he went to the University of Oregon. Every once in a while he'd come back with a couple of cases of wine for me. And he would bring Zinfandel primarily because it was less expensive than Cabernet. You know, why pay an extra $4 or $5 when you can get Zinfandel from the same producer? And the wines were usually really good. So I drank a lot of that. I would drink a lot, and particularly a lot of Ridge wines. And then slowly but surely added other stuff along the way. Cabernet when I could afford it. Chardonnay because I liked it.
Were there any aha bottles in that?
So yes, there was one in particular, and I wish it was a California wine because I'm in the California wine industry, and I'm a kind of a homer when it comes to this. But yes, I was working. I was just out of college, and I was sort of doing this wine club more for fun than anything else. And we did a wine dinner in Eugene at a funny little French bistro place there, and we drank multiple very expensive red Burgundies that night, including I think it was 1970 76 Clos de Tarte, which was really good. But the reason I can't remember the vintage is because the other wine of the night, which completely blew my mind, was so toweringly above anything I'd ever experienced that it was really a moment where things really turned. It was the 1969 Domaine de la Romanicante La Tâche, which I've never had since. I'd love to try it again, but I'm sure that it's quite different from what it was back in the mid-70s, maybe late 70s. And the it was just extraordinary, and it had this level of complexity and a set of flavors I'd never had before in wine. And it had that thing that I now refer to as Pinot perfume, this sort of perfumey character that only Pinot Noir really does well. And it was eye-opening in that it said, there is a whole nother level here that you just haven't ever experienced, Donald, because you haven't been able to afford the wines or just didn't happen to stumble across them, that are serious wines and that are wonderful to drink. And you often think to yourself, I did myself, gee, I wish I had a whole bottle of this to drink all by myself. And I don't even want to share it. It's so good.
Wow, that's fighting words. Most people talk about sharing wines as...
I think sharing wine is what it's all about. I mean, really, but...
No, but this is
I need a magnum
good.
In order to share this
that
one.
Good. Wow. Well,
I need a magnum to share it.
Has any other wine since produced that same, or not same, you already said that wasn't going to happen.
Well, there were a couple of wines. So let's flip to California, because there were a couple of wines that I had from California that I thought were really amazing. And for example, again, roughly the same time when I was getting interested in wine, the 74 vintage California Cabernets were coming onto the market. Mm. And that was really a seminal year. I tried as many of the 74s as I possibly could over the year, on release, but then, you know, years afterward as well. And there's one particular Cabernet from 1974, which I had multiple times in wine tastings with some of the big guys, and it was consistently my favorite, and it was the Clos Duval 1974 Napa Valley Cabernet. There was something, again, sort of mysterious about the wine. It wasn't Burgundy, but it was Napa Valley Cabernet, but I just liked it better. There was a silky texture to it. There was this complex note already with really purity, and I just loved it. And I wish I could say that Clos Duval was as great as that ever after. I know that they've gone through some transitions there, but that 74 was super memorable. Then there was one of my other favorite stories about wine is I had a friend who, I just got an email from him recently too. We were talking about wine because I told him I was interested in, so I was telling him some of the wines I was interested in, and he said, you know, I don't think there's any wine that's worth more than... Now, remember when this is in the 70s, right? Late 70s. He says, there's no wine that's really worth more than $5 a bottle. And I said, really? That's interesting. I'll tell you what, Jeff, why don't you come over after work sometime this week, and you bring your favorite $5 bottle of wine, and I'll bring out a wine that I think is really interesting. So Jeff comes over to my house after work, which is like 10:30 at night. and we opened his up, and it was a pleasant, I don't even remember what it was. I think it was like some Cru Bourgeois Bordeaux or something like that. It was no big deal, but it was tasty, but, you know, not too serious. What I brought out was Ridge 1977 Shenandoah, which I don't think they even make this anymore. And we were talking about residual sugar in California wines. This one was specifically said late harvest on it, and I'm pretty sure it was carrying a couple of percent of residual sugar. Who cared? It was glorious. It was delicious. It was rich. It was, you know, just everything you want in Zinfandel, this crazy kind of, you know, medley of different fruits and cranberries and blackberries and rhubarb, and it was amazing. And Jeff's eyes practically popped out of his head. And it was less than 2 months later, Jeff and I are standing in a retail store in Eugene, Oregon, looking at wines together. And he says, do you think I should buy this $20 bottle of white Burgundy? Or remember, $5 is the most you should ever spend for a bottle of wine. Or should I get this, you know, expensive California Cabernet? And I'm just laughing to myself. I said, 2 months ago, man, you wouldn't even have considered doing this. And I got an email from him not long ago. He said that, it's funny, he said, you really inspired me to an entire lifetime of drinking fun wines. So, there you go.
Well, you ruined somebody's wallet and elevated their palate. You gotta take credit.
Sort of, that's probably the story of my life, is I've ruined my own wallet from time to time. So, it's not, I suppose, turnabout is fair play.
Yes, indeed. So, we now have moved on to the May of 2017, when you requested to be released from your contractual obligation with Saint Michel. And my first question about it is why? Why did you want to move on to other things?
I just thought it sounded like fun. The fact of the matter is that I wasn't interested in just sitting around the house. So, they were essentially offering me an opportunity to kind of, you know, sort of work part-time and kind of like hang out if I wanted to and not do anything if I didn't want to, and which sort of sounded amusing, but not really very fulfilling. And you don't get to this point in a career if you don't have some real burning desire to do something. As opposed to sit around the house. So I knew that if I just said, no, I'm not going to work anymore, I'm just going to sit here, I would have literally just sat around the house, maybe gone out and done a little bit of traveling and stuff. But I found a long time ago, I went on vacation, and usually I'm restless on vacations because I want to go back and start doing the stuff that's really on my mind. But I did this vacation where we went sailing, and it was like the best thing I'd ever done. I don't really want to have to do it every year, but it was really cool because you're engaged the whole time. You're sailing, not motoring. You actually have to worry about the wind, and you have to figure out where the shallow parts are. And I was there with a guy who knew what he was doing, but still, we were having discussion about where we wanted to go and how we wanted to get there. And every day you got up, you had some, it was fun, but at the same time you had things you needed to do. And it was a real great distraction. I couldn't use my phones, you know, I couldn't do any of those things. It was really great. So I thought, it's clear that I can't do the long, that sort of sit at the beach vacation, but I could do something new. And I wanted to do some new things. I had new ideas, fresh ideas for me anyway, that I wanted to try out. And so at that point in my career, I knew that even 2 more years would be like too long. At the end of 2 years, I probably wouldn't be in the same position where I would want to continue to do stuff, to create new things or pursue new wine projects. So I knew I had to get free and start right away, or I probably wouldn't ever get a chance to do it again. That's why I wanted to get out then.
Well, thank you for your candor. How did you come about conceptualizing more than one brand?
Well, I'm not a big believer that a brand can encapsulate lots and lots of different wines. I mean, I heard this a lot when I was doing sales, is, you know, he said, well, I want the best wine from Patson Hall, and I'm going to put that on my wine list. I'm not going to put 5 wines from Patson Hall on. And so when I was thinking about doing these different kinds of wines, I knew right away that each one would have to have their own story and their own name so that they could be their own thing, as opposed to just one big Donald Patz thing, which, of course, I can't actually use on the front label anyway. So the first one, I mean, that's sort of the first one that's really obvious, is the Maritana wines, because it's Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, which is sort of an obvious move for me, right? Also Russian River, we've done a bunch of stuff in Russian River, so this is all sort of logical. That was the easiest one, but the one that I knew I was going to have to do was the Secret Door Cabernet. The reason I knew I was going to have to do that is because when I met the woman who's now my wife, she was living in Virginia, And we were having a discussion about whether she might move to California to be with me or not. And she said, I don't really like Pinot Noir anyway.
And so you're still married.
25 years of making Pinot Noir. And the woman that you love tells you that she doesn't really like Pinot Noir anyway. Oh, she'd rather drink Bordeaux or Napa Valley Cabernet.
Ouch.
So, being one of the things that comes out in, even if you weren't, and I was never formally trained to be a salesperson, but one of the things that really becomes obvious is you have to overcome, you know, objections. And so this was an objection. I had to overcome it. So the way I overcame it was I said, fine, if you move to California to be with me, I'll make Cabernet Sauvignon for you. And I asked her more fairly recently if she thought I was really going to do it or not. And she said she didn't think I would. So it's sort of ironic. But in fact, we did. So we started the Secret Door specifically for her. I mean, I love Cabernet. It's really fun to make it. It's really it's a different kind of challenge. And I have great people I'm working with in the Napa Valley to get the grapes that I want to create this wine. But it's been, yeah, it's really... It's a promise kept kind of thing. It's kind of amusing. So that's where that came about. And who, of course, wouldn't want to make Napa Valley Cabernet given the opportunity to do so? It's one of the greatest places in the world to grow Cabernet. And the reason I say that is, you know, Bordeaux doesn't make 100% Cabernet Sauvignon. At least none that I know of. It's, you know, Bordeaux is primarily a Merlot place. It's 80... I read this just not that long ago. I couldn't believe it myself. 80% of the land in Bordeaux is planted to Merlot. Even your favorite fairly high percentage Cabernet Sauvignon has still got Merlot and Cab Franc and who knows what else. Malbec, Petit Verdot, potentially all blended in. And I get why they do that, but I don't think it's necessary in the Napa Valley. So I wanted to pursue that. Those two were easy. At this point, now we're talking about May 1st, now we're at June 1st, 2017. Now let's say June 15th, that's probably best. And I knew this friend of mine, Jack Edwards, who's an importer for a number of different Northern Rhone Valley wines, was at the Aspen Food and Wine Festival, and I called him, curious about whether it was worth going to. I mean, should I go next year? Should I try to go? Should I see if I can get somebody to give me an invitation? What would be worth doing? So I called him when he was there, and we had a short conversation where he basically said it was fun, but he wasn't sure he was getting a lot out of it. And at the end, it sounded almost like a throwaway part of the conversation. He said, oh, and by the way, I'm sitting here at the bar with Francois Villard from Côte Rôtie and Condrieu, and he's talking about doing another California project. He'd done one with Minor Family previously. So if he does that, would you be interested? And I said, I don't really know Francois that well, but if he wants to come out to California, I'd be happy to hang out with him for a few days and walk around vineyards with him and see if first of all we're sort of compatible, and second, if there's a source of grapes that we could make wine from. And so he did. That was the beginning of June, middle of June probably. He came out about 6 weeks later, at the beginning of second week, I think it was, of August 2017. And we found some grapes we really liked and started a third project called Terminum, which is a collaboration between Francois and myself, making Rhone-style wines from California grapes. So that's been a blast. All of these have been really fun.
Is that it, or is there more labels coming?
No, who knows? Okay. You just heard what I said about Riesling. Somebody's going to thrust Riesling at me now, I'm sure. Good. And who knows, I'll have to come up with something for that, but probably not. Three seems like plenty. In fact, the name Terminum is sort of intended to say, this is the end of the line. So, no, I won't go any farther, and I don't want to create any new brands.
I was wondering where Terminum came from.
So it's derived. It's a made-up name, but basically it's based off the... Roman god of borders and boundaries, Terminus. Mm. And so, yeah, that's basically why I used it. Also, the Rhone Valley has a long history of Roman rule, and apparently almost every little, you know, knoll there, if you dig around a little bit, you'll come up with Roman artifacts. I mean, they were just everywhere, up and down the entire length of the Rhone Valley, back in the olden days. So I wanted there to be a reflection of that history in the Rhone Valley, sort of translating to California.
And what is made under that label?
So there's two wines. A white wine I call Cépage d'Or, which is grapes of gold or golden grapes, whatever you want to call it. That's a Marsan-Roussan blend for 2017. In 2018, Francois and I convinced our friend Stu Bewley at Alder Springs to kick in just a little bit of Viognier and Pique Poule Blanc. So the 2018 is four grapes, and then we did a Syrah as well. The Syrah is beautiful. It's two different parts of his vineyard, and I think is one of the more interesting Syrahs from California. Not in that really big, thick, juicy style. Definitely much more savory style and focused.
I can tell you've been hanging around a Frenchman because of how you said Pique Poule Blanc.
Pique Poule Blanc.
So it's very important that you practice that.
I'm trying. I wish I spoke another language. I know you speak multiple languages, and I'm always jealous of people who can, because I think it really does, it develops a different part of your brain. And so I wish that I'd been in a place where other languages would have been required.
I'm
American.
Not too late. You have so much time on your hands.
I've got so much time on my hands. I got nothing else to do. To sit around and learn. I need to learn Korean now so that I can speak to my wife. That would be great, but that's probably not going to happen either.
Well, if you start doing market visits, I'm just not closing the door on anything. Speaking of the door, so we're going backwards now. We went.
We can jump around. Yeah, we can jump around.
That secret door. Why secret? Why door?
Oh, I thought it was a really... I mean, if you see the label, you'll see a real secret door. This is... It probably doesn't look like it. It's kind of a bright red door, but it wasn't quite that bright. I've tweaked it with filters and stuff. I was invited to do an event at the Aman Hotel in Beijing, and I think it was in 2008 or 2009. And staying at the Aman Hotel, which is part of the Summer Palace grounds, the original Summer Palace grounds of the Empress from some God only knows how far back, was really interesting. And there's usually a line to get in to see this. It's like going into Central Park. It's not a small place. It's not like, you know, a place. It's temples and little pagodas and stuff all over. There's a big lake in the middle of it. So usually there's, you know, a long line of people getting in almost all times of the year. But if you stay at the Aman Hotel, they walk you to the back of their property and they open this secret door and let you in. And then you call the front desk and they come back and unlock the door and let you back in whenever you want. And I thought that was so cool. I took a picture of the door and I thought, that's just amazing. And like a lot of us back at that point, you know, this ended up as a digital picture on my computer. And then it would come up on screensavers. So I'd be, you know, like different pictures of different places I'd been. And then suddenly this door picture would come up. And I, you know, sort of kept saying to myself, secret door, that's a secret door. I thought it was cool. And so I'm trying to come up with a name for this new Cabernet project. And secret door just sort of made some sense. It wasn't being used, which is one of the big things that you find. You try to come up with a name. Just a good exercise for this, if you're curious as to how people come up with names, just write down four or five names that you think would be fun to use as a wine name, and then Google them with wine afterwards and see how many of them are already taken. My guess is that all of the ones you think of will, because it took me a long time to come up with names that other people hadn't. Secret Door is literal, and I think that's important for... It's a mnemonic. It's its own mnemonic that way. So it's easier to remember names like Secret Door than it is, you know, made up names like Terminum or even Maritana. But I just thought it was intriguing. There's symbolism here too. Secrets are, everybody thinks secrets are cool. Everybody wants to know a secret. It's really hard to keep secrets, frankly. But I think people think secrets are interesting and intriguing and mysterious. Doors, everybody, I think when you ask somebody to define a door, they'll usually talk about it, you know, being the way in to something or the way out of something. But doors actually have three different properties. They can be open, they can be closed but not locked, and they can be locked. And each one of those is a different thing. So open door doesn't take any effort to go through it. A closed door that's not locked requires, it's possible to get through it, but it requires, you know, some effort in order to get there. And then locked doors are tough. Locked doors are, you know, sort of defying a defiance of your wish. It's not easy to get through, and it may not be possible to. So I think all of those things bring together some mystery and some, you know, sort of almost metaphysical kinds of references. And I liked all of that, so it made sense.
Single wine made under that label, or?
I'm sorry?
Just one bottling from that label.
So Secret Door, the original one with the red label on it, is the reason I refer to it this way. You'll find out in a second. We're going to change the doors every year on the label. The original one is actually two parts. So it was purchased wine, which I never, ever thought I would do. But the wine was so fabulous. I tasted this wine and could not believe that it was available for sale. So it was actually purchased before I left Patson Hall, and it was intended to go into my stepson's wine project. But when I realized I was going to be leaving, I asked if I might be able to have part of it back in order to be able to start Secret Door, and eventually I took it all back. Two different lots, one that we refer to now as Lot Secret 1X and Lot Secret 1Z. So they're both from the same source, which I cannot disclose because of a non-disclosing agreement. But they're from the same vineyard source, made by the same person originally. We picked the wine up months after it was finished fermenting and finished the aging process and bottled it. So 1X is from the flatter, rockier part of the vineyard. 1Z is from the steepest part of the vineyard. And the resulting wines, I think, are really intriguing and very much in the style that I want Secret Door going forward. So if this was really a weird outlying wine, I wouldn't have done it, even though it was delicious and I liked it. I also thought, yeah, this is the style of Cabernet I want to make. So Cabernet, this is going to take a few minutes to talk about Cabernet, because we've spent so much time talking about Chardonnay and Pinot Noir with the old Patson Hall stuff. Starting over, I really felt like I had this opportunity to kind of wipe the slate clean, take all of the stuff that we'd thought about with Patson Hall, and set it aside and rethink whatever I wanted to do from scratch. So Cabernet has an interesting trajectory in the Napa Valley. It started off with wines that were probably, well, of course, the labels say 12 or 12.5% from the 70s, but nobody ever checked those, by the way. There was no government association you had to apply to and prove that those wines were really whatever you were putting on the label. And oftentimes, people were printing multiple years in a row. 12.5 just simply means it's under 14% alcohol. That's really all anybody should walk away thinking when they see that on a label. If they think that it's really 12.5%, well, let's run the numbers and see what they turn out to be. In certain cases, I'm sure that there are some that were that percentage, but I know some that were made in the 70s that were 14 plus.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.